Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Law and Justice Committee, and I'll call the committee to order. My name is Manka Tingra. I am the chair of this very fine committee and represent the 45th Legislative District. We have a full agenda before us, as always, but before we begin, I would like to go over the guidelines for engagement during this virtual meeting. Members, please do stay on camera unless you have technical issues that web testifiers can see you. As is customary at committee hearings, please raise your hand to ask a question. And since we are on Zoom, please do mute yourself when you have finished asking your question. To everyone who has signed up to testify, sent in their written comments, or indicated their position on a bill, thank you so much for participating and for providing your feedback. Once a bill is introduced, the testifiers will be moved to become panelists. Please do keep yourself off camera and on mute until called to testify. After your testimony, please go ahead and mute yourself and take yourself off camera. Please do stay until the entire panel is done testifying in case there are any questions from members. Members and staff can access meeting materials in EBB, and the public can follow along with the documents by going to the ledge.wa.gov website and looking for committee schedules. And with that, I would now like to ask our members to introduce themselves, starting with our ranking member, Senator Pat.
Thank you very much, Senator Tingra, and good Tuesday morning to everybody. I'm State Senator Mike Patton, representing the 4th Legislative District, which goes from the Spokane city limits all the way to the Idaho border, and soon we'll be going up to the Ponderay County line on the north, and the south border will be the pretty much the limits of the city of the Spokane Valley.
Thank you. And I do know Senator Patton and Senator Solomon are joining us telephonically and not in a position to introduce themselves. So I am now going to next ask Senator Wagner to introduce himself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Keith Wagoner, representing the 39th Legislative District, parts of Skagit, Snohomish, and King counties. And I'm waving and saying hello to my neighbor, Representative Lakanoff, who I'm happy to see this morning.
Thank you. Next up will be Senator Cooter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Patty Cooter from the 48th Legislative District, parts of Bellevue, Redmond, Kirkland, all of Yarrow Point, Hunts Point, Medina, and Clyde Hill. And good morning.
Good morning. Next up will be Senator McHugh.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Senator McEwen. I represent the 2nd Legislative District, most of North Thurston, and lots of South Pierce County. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And with that, we are going to move to our to public hearing on our first bill, Substitute House Bill 1725. And it is my pleasure to welcome Representative Lakanoff to this fine committee.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Representative Deborah Lakanoff out of the 40th Legislative District, which is the beautiful San Juan Islands, Skagit, bumping up to my friend, Senator Wagner's area, and then also representing south of Bellingham. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to see you all, and thank you for having me. Today, I want to introduce
Why don't we start with staff briefing, and then we'll give you an opportunity to speak about your bill.
Thank you.
Staff, can we have a briefing on the bill, please?
Of course. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ryan Giannini, staff counsel with this committee. Before you today, Substitute House Bill 1725 relating to the creation of an Endangered Missing Person Advisory designation for missing Indigenous persons. By way of background, the Amber Alert system is a system in which broadcasters, cable systems, and law enforcement agencies voluntarily cooperate to assist in finding abducted children. When a missing person does not qualify for an alert under the Amber Alert system, an Endangered Missing Person Advisory Alert may be activated. Washington's Endangered Missing Person Advisory Plan includes a Silver Alert designation to assist in the recovery of missing endangered persons age 60 or older. The Washington State Patrol is responsible for operating a Missing Children and Endangered Person Clearinghouse that distributes information to local law enforcement agencies, school districts, the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, and the general public regarding missing children and endangered persons. The Washington State Patrol is also responsible for developing and implementing Amber Alert plans and Endangered Missing Person Advisory plans for voluntary cooperation between local, state, tribal, and other law enforcement agencies. state government agencies, radio and television stations, cable and satellite systems, and social media pages and sites to enhance the public's ability to assist in recovering abducted children and missing endangered persons. Substitute House Bill 1725 requires the Washington State Patrol to develop and implement an endangered missing person advisory plan, which includes both Silver Alert and Missing Indigenous Persons Alert designations. Missing Indigenous Person Alert means a missing and endangered person advisory that will be used on a variable message sign and highway advisory radio message when used as part of an activated advisory to assist in the recovery of a missing Indigenous person. A fiscal note is available, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Ryan. Committee screen's open at the moment. Do any members have any questions for staff? Seeing none, Representative Lekanoff, we would love to hear from you about your bill.
I was so excited to see you guys. I just jumped right into it, Senator. Good morning. It's great to be here for the record again. Deborah Lekanoff of the 40th Legislative District. Greetings to my good friend, Senator Wagner. You know, across this great nation for many, many, many years, we've been watching the growing crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Not only is it a crisis here within Washington State, but it's a crisis across the United States. They have the road of tears running through Canada, where we also are facing missing and murdered Indigenous women. I come from the state of Alaska. We also have the same situation. The crisis has grown to where we have thousands of cold cases. We have hundreds of families torn apart. The opportunity we find here today is what Washington does best. We bring people together. We remove barriers. We make sure every Washingtonian knows that they're cared for, knows that we will help them, and that we will do things better and stronger. The Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's and People's Alert System removes the hand that we've seen in many of the depictions of missing and murdered Indigenous women. We can now, through the alert system, hear their screams. We can now hear them hollering for help. The broadcasters brought this bill to me and wanted to be part of resolving this crisis amongst our state and amongst our nation. Our Washington State Patrol, our tribes, our communities are saying we need to be able to address this, and we can do it together as the Washington State Legislature. I hope that this alert system rings across every alert product that we have, whether it's your cell phone, whether it's your laptop, whether it's a broadcasting across the networks. We want to be able to move this forward and to be able to help make sure that we alert all Washingtonians that a woman has been torn from her family and that her unheard screams will now be heard. I applaud each and every one of you for standing with me on this important bill, and I hope that you will help me pass this through our Senate. It passed unanimously across the House floor. My colleagues and my friends on the Republican side understand that when a woman goes missing, it doesn't matter if you're a Republican, a Democrat. It doesn't matter whether or not you're a senator or a representative. This is something we all should care about, each and every one of us. And we do that as true Washingtonians. So thank you, Senator. I turn the floor back to you.
Thank you so much for that. Do any members have any questions for the prime sponsor? Seeing none, I am now going to open public testimony. I would just like to say to Karen Condon, please accept the link to be promoted to panelists so that we may hear from you. And while that happens, I'm going to invite Annie Forsman Adams to please begin.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Dingra and fellow members of the Law and Justice Committee. My name is Annie Forsman Adams, and I currently serve as the policy analyst for the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and People Task Force under the Attorney General's Office. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 1725 on MMIWP alerts. Indigenous people go missing and are murdered at high rates across the United States. And according to research from the Urban Indian Health Institute, Indigenous women go missing 4 times more often than white women do in Washington. While there has been significant work done at the tribal, state, and grassroots level to address this crisis, we must continue to move towards justice with legislation like 1725. This bill will not only provide additional tools to law enforcement, but it starts to address some of the inequities with information sharing and media coverage among Indigenous communities. As Indigenous people continue to go missing throughout our region, it is the families that are most impacted by the limited tools law enforcement has to share information and engage with the public. While grappling with grief, trauma, and loss, families are often left to carry the burden of engaging with the media, posting missing persons flyers, and using their own resources to bring their relatives home quickly. As a Suquamish woman and an advocate for missing Indigenous people, the stories of missing women have been constant in my personal and professional life. Families are often left to look for their loved ones on their own, and law enforcement has few tools to engage with media and disseminate public information. House Bill 1725 starts to close this gap by engaging in ways that address the disparity and call for accountability. While there is still much work to do, 1725 is one step on a long journey towards justice. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you so much. Next up will be Mark Allen, and I'll just like to let Karen Condon know we see her as an attendee, but we really need her to accept the link to be promoted as a panelist. Thank you. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Chair Dingra and members of the committee. Mark Allen, for the record, representing the Washington State Association of Broadcasters. And I'll be brief because the staff and Representative Lakanoff and Annie have done a great job in describing what this bill does. It creates a specified portion of the Endangered Missing Persons Advisory Plan for this specific purpose. It will bring more visibility to a situation that has long gone, ignored in many instances. And the broadcasters are proud to be an active partner as a pathway to get this information out to the general public. The more eyes we have out seeing people, looking for people, the more we'll be able to address this issue. It's modeled after the Silver Alert, which has been very successful, very efficient, and has resulted in returning many of our senior citizens who needed assistance to get back to safety, but needed assistance to do that. So we think that this will be an enhancement. As Annie said, and Representative Lakanoff said, it's a first step in the direction to make this a very important and very visible situation. So we support Substitute House Bill 1725. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. And to bring this all back together, we're going to hear from Karen Condon. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My name is Karen Condon, Caldwell Business Council, Confederated Tribes of the Caldwell Reservation. Good morning, Chairwoman Dingra, Vice Chairwoman Trudeau, and members of the committee. The Caldwell Tribe supports Substitute House Bill 1725, which prioritizes locating missing Indigenous people. However, nothing in the definition of missing endangered person in Section 2, Subsection B, prioritizes missing Indigenous people. The definition includes age-related criteria to prioritize children and vulnerable adults with age-related dementia, health, mental, and physical disability. But nothing in the definition of missing Indigenous person specifically references missing Indigenous people. The Caldwell Tribes would also like to make reference to the 2018 DOJ report to Congress regarding the implementation of the Ashland Mike Amber Alert in Indian Country Act of 2018. In this report, 34% of the Amber Alert coordinators cited the tribe's lack of infrastructure in regards to radio broadcasting road signs to support accessing the state's Amber Alert plan as a challenge. Voluntary cooperation doesn't get us to the finish line. Lastly, RCW 43.376.020 establishes the state agency's duty to consult and collaborate with Indian tribes in the development of policies, agreements, and program implementation that directly affects Indian tribes. The Caldwell Tribes ask that legislature include consultation language in the bill so that tribes have the ability to shape the Washington State Patrol's Endangered Missing Person Advisory Plan for Missing Indigenous Women and Persons Alert. establishing guidance on criteria for issuing an alert and identifying who has final activation or short authority should be a joint decision between the tribes and the Washington State Patrol. Thank you. Lim Limt.
Thank you so much. Senator Wagner, I see you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question was for Annie. She cited a pretty alarming statistic, 4-1. I'm just wondering if she knows if that is normalized per capita or in absolute numbers. Either way, it's pretty alarming, but I'm just, for my own edification, wondering if you know the answer to that.
I do not know the answer to that off the top of my head.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you everyone for testifying. We're going to close the public hearing on Substitute House Bill 1725, and we're now going to open public hearing on House Bill 1105. And staff, if we can get a briefing, please.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Joe McKittrick, staff counsel to this committee. House Bill 1105 concerns arrest protections for the medical use of cannabis. By way of background, specific types of healthcare professionals may authorize a qualifying patient's medical use of cannabis. As such, the qualifying patient has certain legal protections not afforded to recreational users, can cultivate cannabis at home, and that can possess a larger quantity of cannabis than a recreational user. A qualifying patient is a person who is a patient of a healthcare professional, has been diagnosed as having a terminal or debilitating medical condition, is a resident of Washington at the time of diagnosis, has been advised of the risks and benefits of the use of cannabis, has been advised that the patient may benefit from the use of cannabis, and has an authorization form from the patient's healthcare provider or has been entered into the medical marijuana authorization database and has been provided a recognition card. A designated provider means a person who is at least 21 years old and is designated in writing by a qualifying patient to serve as the designated provider for the patient, or if the qualifying patient is under 18, is the qualifying patient's parent or guardian, and has an authorization form from the qualifying patient's healthcare provider. In 2015, the Department of Health developed and implemented the Medical Marijuana Authorization Database. If information is placed in the database, the patient or provider must be provided a recognition card that contains certain identifiers. A patient or provider who has entered into the database and has a recognition card may not be arrested, prosecuted, or subject to other criminal sanctions or civil consequences for certain violations of state law regulating the use and possession of marijuana. A patient or provider who is not entered into the database does not have a recognition card is not provided these protections against criminal sanctions or civil consequences, but may under certain circumstances raise their status as a patient or provider as an affirmative defense at trial. If enacted, House Bill 1105 would eliminate the affirmative defense for patients or providers who are not entered into the database and instead would grant those individuals the same protections against criminal sanctions and civil consequences as those individuals who are entered into the database. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you so much. Do any of the members have any questions for staff? Seeing none, the prime sponsor was unable to join us today, but she did send in her testimony via email. And with that, I would like to invite Stephen Field to please introduce himself and begin.
Good morning. Thank you to the committee for listening. My name is Stephen Field, and I'm here to ask for your support in the passage of HB 1105 concerning the arrest protection for medical use of cannabis. I hold a medical marijuana authorization from the Swedish MS Center. I've been living with secondary progressive MS for almost 30 years. Most recently, in December of 2019, I suffered a major setback and had a stroke that left me in the hospital and two different rehab centers for a total of 4 months. After a ride back home, I still couldn't stand, walk, turn myself over, or complete the simplest of tasks. I have exhausted all the traditional medical routes in trying to treat my diseases, including an implanted of a pain pump, which delivered dangerous narcotics to my spine, which eventually failed. Since the beginning of my disease, I find that cannabis and its natural healing properties have helped me the most. I am just one of the many cannabis patients throughout the state that have the need to grow our own medical-grade cannabis. As it is, we're already overwhelmed with serious health issues that don't need the worry and fear of intrusive regulatory or criminal law encounters, which can impact our health. And additionally, we don't feel comfortable releasing information into the state registry, and past events prove it's not exactly secure. We just don't want to be treated like criminals for the simple act of growing and using a plant. We're just a diverse group of patients trying to live life as best we can. We're asking for your support and compassion in the form of common sense legislation, which will bring us in parity with the many other states. I know you have a lot of work to get done this short session, but this bill is really important to people throughout the state, myself included. I hope that you'll see that it's important enough to pass this session. I'm more than happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Next up is going to be Lisa Buchanan.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Lisa Buchanan, and I'm in the quality of life business. I do that in a number of different ways. I'm a registered nurse here in Washington for 30 years and an OCN emeritus. I volunteer in my community and am a board member for a nonprofit that provides free classes and support groups for cancer patients, survivors, and caregivers. And then I work as a medical educator, bud tender, and medical marijuana consultant. I fill those roles at Washington's longest medically endorsed chain of cannabis retail stores and in the community for healthcare institutions, seniors, and interested parties. I see medical marijuana patients every day of my working life. And I've worked with all 13 categories of patients that can be medically endorsed in Washington. But my specialty is cancer care. And I worked with these patients from diagnosis to completion of therapy or their death from disease. What all of these patients have in common is that they're in crisis and they're searching for symptom relief and quality of life that standard medical options have not met. Cannabis offers supportive care, autonomy, and hope to these patients. They aren't criminals, they are sick people. We need not start with the assumption that they are criminals. They are people like your parents, neighbors, and coworkers who deserve respect and for their personal medical treatment decisions, empathy, and the presumption of innocence that all other citizens of Washington State receive. Please make this a reality by supporting House Bill 1105. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Next up is going to be Mary Brown.
Hi, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you very much for having me here today. My name is Mary Brown, and I am the founder of SMJ Consulting at the Ames Institute. The Ames Institute is the Advanced Integrative Medical Science Institute of Seattle, and I am here today in support of House Bill 1105. I would just like to make the statement that the influx of patients that we see on a daily basis, much like my speakers before me, are indeed using cannabis as a medicine, both in conjunction with allopathic treatments as well as with naturopathic treatments. At our clinic, we are one of the many clinics in Washington State that are vetting out patient use of cannabis-based medicine. These patients are not using this product simply to get high. They are using it, as scientific research has proven, for symptom management, as well as targeting specific conditions. There is an influx of research globally right now at the various amounts of cannabis, cannabinoids we call them, that patients are needing in order to target symptom management. And we understand that the needs of each patient varies. So we would like to stand in support of this bill on behalf of patients who often are really at the end of their options in allopathic medicine, as well as inundated with the day-to-day issues of living with a terminal illness, and often reauthorizing their medical authorization is very difficult for them. So with that, I stand in support of this bill, and I hope that you will consider doing so as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next up is going to be John Kingsbury.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, for the record, my name is John Kingsbury. I've been an authorized cannabis patient since 2009. Appreciating the workload of this committee, I'll make this short and sweet and then submit my full comments in writing. As a cannabis patient, I cannot begin to describe the medical struggles I've gone through during the past 20 years. I eventually came to cannabis because of the toll that pharmaceuticals were taking on my health and quality of life. Cannabis has improved that quality of my life and helped me to be a more engaged person. This bill has progressed quickly with strong support. I believe this is because it speaks to common sense and basic human decency. This bill says, if an authorized patient has contact with law enforcement and he or she is showing no evidence of violating the law, then they cannot be arrested, period. This bill does nothing to protect those who are not following the law. If the current standard of guilty until proven innocent in a court of law may have had some rationale during 2014, it certainly does not today, especially for well-vetted patients who are already have challenging lives. I hope you'll support HB 1105. Thank you, and I can take questions if you like.
Thank you so much. Next up will be Taylor Gardner.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Taylor Gardner, and I am the Deputy Policy Director for the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, and I am here to testify respectfully opposed to House Bill 1105. We understand that the last two decades, medical marijuana use in the state of Washington has been considered lawful, and I'm not here to contest that today. But in 2012, Initiative 502 passed, and it was in the spirit that a strong regulatory scheme always remain in place. And with that, I would request the committee consider here, with a particular focus on the home grow provisions, a stronger regulatory scheme. There is no shortage of marijuana in this state, and we have concerns over any legislation that potentially increases risks to public safety. So while we do not support broadening marijuana provisions generally, if the committee intends to move forward with such legislation, I would like to encourage everyone here to look to implement safeguards around the home grow provisions in order to prevent unnecessary risks from arising later on. Other states have implemented such safeguards, and I would like to highlight a couple of those as examples for this committee. For example, in addition to a total plant limit per home, perhaps including a reduced plant limit per person, a requirement that plants be grown within a closet, room, greenhouse, or somewhere with a security device, a requirement that even with a security device, persons under 21 years old cannot access such plants, implementing a requirement that plants cannot be visible from a public space, and lastly, a requirement that the grower either own the property or have written permission from the legal owner. These provisions would simply serve to protect various community members, such as children in the homes, but also the home growers themselves. To the extent that I can be helpful in following up with the committee on any of these provisions, I'm happy to, but thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Next up will be John Worthington. You're on mute, John.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, John Worthington, for the record. I oppose the bill, but I would support it with amendments. We're this far along in the woke era, and we still have marijuana in the same schedule as heroin. So I would alter the bill with that in mind. I would not allow or require regular flower to be on the registry. I would only allow the derivative process and those who were planning on making derivatives to be the ones required to register, because we haven't really proven that marijuana is as dangerous as heroin, and it's probably not even schedulable. And all these years, law enforcement and other folks have been able to have a different rule promulgation process than international building codes. And when you look at the international building codes, you'll see that we're not promulgating drug schedules the same. So, and if we did promulgate them, we would find that THC basically is offset. So we'd probably have a different policy altogether if we had a realistic one. So I'm trying to gear the policy towards an realistic rescheduling where marijuana belongs. And I don't think that having flower, people growing flowers should, even if they're not medical, I don't think that we should be worrying about them. And I would just take the database and make it only for derivative process. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Very intriguing idea there. Do any members have any questions for any of the panelists? Yes, Senator Cooter.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Worthington, I apologize if I missed this, but I noticed that your organization is the AAMC. Could you please tell me what that acronym stands for?
American Alliance for Medical Cannabis.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Wagner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Taylor. You had a list of things that you thought would make the bill more palatable. Have you discussed any of those with the bill sponsor, and did you get some feedback?
Thank you, Senator. I personally have not had any conversations with the bill sponsor, but to the extent that conversation is welcome, I'm happy to follow up. Like we said, our focus is really on the home grow, just trying to anticipate that and get in front of it as much as possible with provisions that would help keep the community and people within the homes themselves safe.
Thank you. Senator Trudeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is also for Taylor. Is there an issue with home grows that you all have identified in bringing forward these suggestions? I guess I haven't heard anything related to the problem being identified by some of them. So curious if you could elaborate, and maybe we could check in offline if you don't have that information available.
Yes, Senator. The brief answer is, unfortunately, we have been told by various officers and agencies that when you invite home grow in a way that people can find out about perhaps more easily, then you're also inviting opportunities for people to take advantage of that. So we've heard of various robberies and burglaries and other unfortunate circumstances in which those who've chosen to grow a home have been victims simply because people outside of the homes knew about it. And we know that cannabis retail is also subject to these victimizations. So to the extent that we can protect people in their homes, we do find that to be a priority. And we would love for this committee to consider putting some parameters around that.
And John Kingsbury, I see your hand up. I'm assuming you have an answer to Senator Trudeau's question.
So just to be clear, I'm a little confused by Taylor Gardner's comments. This is not a home grow bill. There are, for instance, she suggested that there would be differentials in levels of growing, and those are already built in. Those aren't being altered. She seems to be talking about this like this is a home grow bill. There's going to be no changes to limits or any of the rules around what the provisions are or public view. I'm kind of confused by her comments. This is not a home grow bill.
Okay, thank you, John. We're just going to make sure we just answer the questions asked instead of having the discussion. Any other questions from any of the members? Okay, seeing none, thank you all so much. And we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 1105. Thank you all so much. We are now going to open public hearing on House Bill 1719. And we're going to start with briefing from staff.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Tim Ford, staff with the committee. Before you is House Bill 1719 concerning the use and acquisition of military equipment by law enforcement agencies. And by way of background, currently a law enforcement agency may not acquire or use any military equipment. And if a law enforcement agency is in possession of military equipment, they have to either return the equipment to the federal agency from which it was acquired or destroy the equipment no later than December 31st of this year. And items which constitute prohibited military equipment are listed in the bill report. They range from firearms and ammunition of 50 caliber or greater, machine guns, armed helicopters, drones, vessels, vehicles, and aircraft, tanks, rockets, rocket launchers, bayonets, grenades, missiles, directed energy system, and electromagnetic spectrum weapons. So what this bill does is it amends the definition of military equipment so that it no longer includes firearms or ammunition of 50 caliber or greater, but that does not include rifles of 50 caliber or greater. So rifles of 50 caliber or greater are still included in the definition of military equipment. So what this change does is it permits law enforcement agencies to use and acquire ammunition of 50 caliber or greater and other types of firearms of 50 caliber or greater, but not rifles of 50 caliber or greater. And then it also amends the definition of rifle to exclude any shotgun or any device designed or used to deploy less lethal munitions. And that would include things like beanbags, rubber balls, and other non-penetrating rounds, or any less lethal equipment. A fiscal note is available. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Senator Patton.
Yes, thank you, Tim. So under current law then, the beanbags and other soft nose items cannot be used if they're from a 50 caliber. Is that right?
I think that is correct, that if it were from a 50 caliber weapon, it would not be permitted. But if it were not, I think it would be permitted. And I will double check on that for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from any members? Seeing none, we are now going to invite the panelists to begin. I will like to point out that the 9 people signed in to testify, they're all pro. So, and I know you're all seasoned testifiers, so we can keep this nice and short and sweet. And we're going to start with Chief Jeff Myers.
Thank you. Good morning. I appreciate your time, Senator and the members of the committee. Real brief, since this is a pretty straightforward bill. Last session, I have to admit that all of us that worked on much of this legislation completely missed the fact that 50 caliber restriction would apply to a shotgun, which is technically a .7484, I believe. And so this is an unintended consequence. And I give credit to Representative Johnson and Representative Goodman in spearheading the correction to this. They've worked on this legislation extensively, meeting with stakeholders, and the intent behind 1310, which was to provide less lethal options to our officers. So since this has an emergency provision, I'm looking forward to this bill hopefully moving quickly through the Senate to the governor's desk. And as of that moment, we will be able to return our less lethal options, and specifically the beanbag shotguns, to all of our vehicles. So thank you for the time.
Thank you so much. Chief Harris from Kirkland. Enough to shout out to the city of Kirkland, so please begin.
Good morning, Chair Dingra, Ranking Member Patton, and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing House Bill 1719 concerning use and acquisition of military equipment by law enforcement agencies. Again, I am Sherry Harris. I'm the Chief of Police of the City of Kirkland Police Department, and on behalf of the officers in Kirkland and the Kirkland City Council, we support 1719. The clarity that House Bill 1719 provides, specifically that any device designed or used to deploy less lethal munitions, will allow police agencies to utilize additional de-escalation tools that provide both time and distance in crisis situations. So again, thank you for hearing this bill and for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you. Next up will be Sharon Swanson.
Good morning, Chair Dingra, members of the Law and Justice Committee. Sharon Swanson speaking on behalf of the Association of Washington Cities. I hear you loud and clear, Senator Dingra. Let's not love this to death. So AWC supports 1719. We thank you so much to the legislators who have worked on this to add this clarification. And I've set my bar. Thank you.
Thank you. Very impressive. James McMahon, it's good to see you. I'm glad you're feeling better.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Happy to feel better. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm James McMahon, Policy Director with the Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs. Pleased to testify in strong support of this bill today. I've heard it said, don't push on an open door. So unless there are any questions, I'll conclude my testimony there.
Thank you. I'm loving this hearing. Next up is going to be Steve Baer.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Steve Baer. I'm the Chief of the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Police. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 1719. I'd like to thank this committee for paying attention to the needs addressed by this bill and acting on it. Importantly, this bill provides clarifying language that shotguns are permissible. The Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife uses shotguns as a normal course of business, but their primary use for us is in dealing with large, injured, or dangerous wildlife. We do this in every setting imaginable across the state. And whether it's urban, suburban, or a rural setting, whenever shot travel distance is a concern, there's really no better tool for us to use. Shotguns are considered primarily a short-range weapon, but they have the stopping power we need to be effective. And because of this, we're in support of House Bill 1719. We thank you for your attention to this. Happy to answer any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next up is going to be Austin Field.
Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I'm a commissioner on Seattle's Community Police Commission, which is a diverse group of community leaders focused on amplifying community voices for police accountability. We do support HB 1719 because we are concerned that limiting less lethal options will increase law enforcement killings. However, law enforcement responses to recent protests has demonstrated that law enforcement agencies do use force, including non-lethal force, far too often. And so we want to ensure that the legislature understands that nonviolent de-escalation techniques should still be emphasized and must be used far more frequently. Finally, as a combat veteran myself, I think it's important to acknowledge that many less lethal weapons, particularly beanbag shotguns and 40 millimeter launchers, are not harmless alternatives to conventional firearms. These weapons are inaccurate and they do cause serious injuries. The New England Journal of Medicine published a study finding that 18% of Minneapolis residents who received medical treatment after being targeted with less lethal projectile weapons during the protests against George Floyd's murder had traumatic brain injuries, and a further 40% had serious injuries to the head, neck, or face. A 2017 review of approximately 2,000 people targeted with less lethal projectile weapons by law enforcement found that 53 people had been killed, 300 had been permanently paralyzed, and 71% of the remaining survivors have been seriously injured. These weapons should only be used in the most dire of circumstances. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. We did have three other individuals signed up to testify who are not present. Do any of the members of the committee have any questions for the panelists? Senator Patton?
Thank you very much, Chair Dingra. I guess this would be for Mr. McMahon or Sharon Swanson, but you know what has happened? I did hear as in the interim here without this clarification, I did hear of an incident down in Longview, Washington, where police were not able to use beanbags because of the restrictions of the law and had to resort to throwing sticks and stones to break up a drug gang. Have there been other incidents like that that have been the result of the legislation that was passed last year that you could inform us of and as to the need for this legislation?
If I can, Madam Chair, Senator, I'll take a stab at that and then certainly invite Sharon to jump in as well. I think that the incident in Vancouver that you were referring to, as I recall it, there was a standoff or a search warrant or something that was being carried out, and officers had to throw rocks at the window and use other sticks or something to help what we call rake the window out, specifically because of the provisions in this bill. I think there are unfortunately countless circumstances where I think we would all agree that officers could and frankly should have used a less lethal munition, particularly in the interest of public safety for everybody involved. But because of the way that this language read and what 50 caliber means in a truly objective setting, those less lethal equipment were simply unavailable for the officers to use. I know some agencies have made the decision to take the risk, frankly, and continue to use some of this equipment. The enactment of this bill makes it clear that all agencies can use that and officers won't face decertification for doing the right thing. So we do support the bill.
Thank you, Senator Patton. I can't add anything really to what Mr. McMahon said, other than we did have some departments who interpreted the legislation to allow them to use the less lethal, and they did so, but this clarification will solve that for everyone and will be consistently enforced. So we're very supportive.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Okay. Seeing none, we are going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 1719. And we will now open public hearing on Substitute House Bill 1735. We'll start with a briefing from staff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, Joe McKittrick, staff counsel to this committee. Substitute House Bill 1735 concerns the standard for the use of force by peace officers and the use of deadly force. Currently, a peace officer may use physical force when necessary to protect against criminal conduct where there is probable cause to make an arrest, effect an arrest, prevent an escape, or protect against an imminent threat of bodily injury to the peace officer, another person, or the person against whom force is being used. A peace officer must use reasonable care when determining whether and when to use physical force. The officer must, when possible, exhaust available and appropriate de-escalation tactics prior to using any physical force. When using physical force, use the least amount of physical force necessary to overcome resistance under the circumstances. Terminate the use of physical force as soon as the necessity for such force ends. When possible, use available and appropriate less lethal alternatives to before using deadly force, and make less lethal alternatives issued to the officer reasonably available for use. A peace officer may use deadly force only when necessary to protect against an imminent threat of serious physical injury or death to the officer or another person. If enacted, Substitute House Bill 1735 would amend the standards for when a peace officer may use physical force to include the use of physical force to the extent necessary to take a person into custody, transport a person for evaluation or treatment, or provide other assistance related to a mental health crisis, take a minor into protective custody, execute or enforce a court order to take a person into custody, execute a search warrant, or execute or enforce an oral directive issued by a judicial officer in a courtroom, or a written order expressly authorizing the use of physical force to enforce the directive or order. Furthermore, peace officers must, when possible, use all de-escalation tactics that are available and appropriate under the circumstances before using physical force. De-escalation tactics are defined by this bill. The standard for a peace officer to use deadly force is amended by limiting its use to only when necessary to protect against an immediate rather than imminent threat of serious physical injury or death to the officer or another person. A peace officer must use less lethal alternatives that are available and appropriate under the circumstances before using deadly force. And the standard for reasonable care is amended to apply to the use of deadly force as well as physical force. A fiscal note is available for this bill, and the bill contains an emergency clause. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you so much, Joe, for that briefing. Do any of the members of the committee have any questions for staff? Senator Patton.
Thank you very much, Chair Dingra. And just had a question. Last year, neck restraints were abolished under the legislation. If this bill were to pass, could that possibly be used? We had evidence that they were a strong de-escalation tactic in studies from Spokane and Pierce County. So anyway, that's my question. What would be the status of neck restraints if this passed?
And thank you for the question, Senator. Currently, this legislation does not discuss the status of neck restraints. What it does do is take the definition of the term de-escalation tactics and moves it under the definition section of RCW 10120010. But other than that, I don't believe that it does contemplate changing the status of neck restraints.
Any other questions from any of the members? Okay, seeing none, I am going to invite our panelists to begin, and I'll just start with Sharon Swanson.
Thank you, Chair Dingra. Again, Sharon Swanson speaking on behalf of the Association of Washington Cities, testifying in support of 1735. Senator Patton, I would actually refer you, trying to answer your question, to page 5 of the bill. There's a sub 4 that says a peace officer may not use any force tactics prohibited or otherwise by law, except to protect his or her life or the life of another person from an imminent threat. So I think that's a situation where if the officer is fighting for their life, they're allowed to use whatever tactic they can. But this bill does not specifically address neck restraints. However, I'll pivot now into my testimony. AWC worked heavily on the legislation last year, and we were supportive and continue to be supportive of the changes. However, we heard very loud and clear from our cities, city attorneys and chiefs, that there did need to be some clarifications around what we're calling community caretaking functions. So clarifying that law enforcement could use force for such instances as to deal with a runaway or maybe an elderly dementia patient who was agitated, or to do a welfare check on a neighbor and gain access to a home. In addition, we all were made aware of some concerns around the behavioral health statutes and needing clarifications there. So we believe as House Bill 1735 strikes a very nice balance. We appreciate very much the prime sponsor's outreach and work, and we are supportive of the legislation. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you so much for that. Next up is going to be Chief Myers.
Thank you. Jeff Myers, Chief of Police of Hoquiam, and I also serve as the chair of the Washington State Crimes Training Commission, but I'm just speaking today on behalf of support of 1735 as an individual. I would like again to echo what Sharon just said and thank the bill sponsors, especially Representative Johnson and Representative Goodman, who worked so hard behind the scenes after last session and all the way through to meet with so many people from every side and every stakeholder. And they listened and they came back. I really appreciate Representative Johnson actually spent time at the Academy and sat through the curriculum and actually got to see some of the training in action and the ability for us to train our new recruits and new officers on all of these important changes. So the biggest things I like to focus on is again, the mental health side. We really know that our system is very strained in the state of Washington, and we've learned very carefully that peace officers and our function, our duties, are key to getting people into involuntary treatment when they don't want to go. That's the nature of involuntary treatment. And sometimes that may involve a minor use of force, such as having to put somebody in a car or transport them or get them out of a car to get them into an emergency room for treatment. And it's important to us that we get those folks to the places that they need to get the psychiatric treatment that they so much deserve. It also allows us to intervene with juvenile runaways that maybe don't want to go. And we can, again, use some de minimis physical force to escort them to the car or whatever it may be to get them into safety. And also executing a search warrant or a court order was very important. We found ourselves sometimes at odds with our superior court when the judge issues an order to do something, but then the officers were inadvertently unable to do so because of the restrictions in the previous legislation. And as well as, I don't know if the courts are going to testify, but we heard loud and clear that when a judge issues an oral directive to maintain order in a court, such as taking someone into custody or because they're unruly, that officers should have the ability to act upon that judicial order immediately. And I know that several members of this committee have a lot of experience in the courtrooms and know that things can de-escalate very quickly. And it's important to keep things safe for everyone when they are doing the business of the public in a courtroom. And last but not least, I have to shout out my wife is a firefighter for City of Aberdeen. And so there is some specific language to recognize the important role our firefighters and designated crisis responders and other mental health professionals play in this system. And that it allows us as peace officers to intervene and protect and help and be that presence to make sure that they too are safe and when they're out in the field doing their jobs. And so I really appreciate all the work, and I would urge the committee to move this bill forward. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Chief Myers. Next up is going to be Chief Harris.
Thank you, Chair Dingra, Ranking Member Patton, and members of the committee. Again, thank you for hearing Senate Substitute House Bill 1735. Again, I am Sherry Harris. I'm the Chief of Police of the Kirkland Police Department, representing the officers who work here in Kirkland and the city, the Kirkland City Council. We support this bill and appreciate very much the many hours spent by the bill's sponsor, Representative Johnson, in ensuring that it's feasible and fair. 1735 provides important clarifications for when an officer can use reasonable force in civil instances where no crime has occurred, such as a mental health crisis. And again, thank you so much for hearing this and for the opportunity to comment. And I would be happy to respond to any questions the committee may have.
Thank you so much. Next up is going to be James Schrimsher.
Good morning, Chair Dingra, Vice Chair Trudeau, Ranking Member Patton, and esteemed members of the committee. As you know, my name is James Schrimsher, and I'm here representing the Washington chapter of the Fraternal Order of Police. I'm also here to express our full support for House Bill 1735. As a peace officer is a composite of all people, the mingling of a saint, a sinner, a dust, and deity. The peace officer must be a minister, a social worker, a diplomat, a tough person, and respectful all at the same time. A peace officer must be such a diplomat that they can settle differences between individuals so that each will think they have won the argument. These words are from a poem spoken nearly 50 years ago by the great Paul Harvey about my profession. This poem, in part, inspired a young man, a young farm boy from central Missouri to join the peace officer profession. And these words have never rang more true today. House Bill 1735 provides that clarity needed when a peace officer responds to a behavioral health call, allowing peace officers to be part of a larger approach to behavioral health crisis. As the one true voice for law enforcement, the FOP is grateful for the opportunity to take part in the conversation around this bill, and we thank you for your consideration of our remarks. I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you so much for that. Next up is going to be Taylor Gardner.
Good morning again, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Taylor Gardner, and I am the Deputy Policy Director for the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, here in strong support for House Bill 1735. I will endeavor to keep my remarks brief in light of the many others here to testify in support of this bill. In short, we believe this bill delivers some of the much needed legislative clarity arising after last year's package of reform bills. We appreciate the hard work that Representative Johnson and the other sponsors have put into this bill to ensure that in the many civil instances accounted for here, law enforcement can respond appropriately where called upon. I will defer to the many experiences and expertise shared by Chief Myers and the other law enforcement executives here in those terms. So we thank you for continuing to move this forward. I just would ask that we all remind ourselves use of force is only helpful to the extent that it's defined. So I would encourage that the legislature continue working on defining force so that bills such as this can be as productive as they are intended to be. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Next up is going to be Diane Ustrander.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Good morning.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Dingra, members of the Senate. I am Diane Ostrander from Redland, Washington, and I'm representing myself and my son in support of Bill 1735. My son has had life-threatening and devastating consequences due to the police in four local cities' confusion over the 1310 bill's use of force. We've been dealing with this since October 24th through 911 calls, citizen complaints, several welfare checks, two missing persons reports, and a DCR mental health warrant. That day is when my son went into a full-blown psychotic episode with paranoia, delusions, and hallucinations. The police in each city refused to take him against his will to the hospital and said he would have to commit a significant crime in order to get medical treatment. Even with a DCR warrant, they all cited the 1310 bill. Eventually on December 3rd, That is exactly what happened in Bellevue. He was arrested for trespassing and sent to SCORE jail, totally psychotic. SCORE did no mental health evaluation. They did not call DCR and released him 19 hours later at 8:30 at night in 38 degrees and raining. He was barefoot in loafers with a thin shirt and thin jacket. Delusional, hallucinating, no money, and not knowing where he was in the dark. He went missing for 7 days the first time and 5 days the next. He was thrown into 25 days of homelessness and life-threatening weather, of rain, snow, 7 degree above weather and winds of 35 miles an hour. Imagine this hell if it was you, freezing cold, hungry, lonely and scared, wandering aimlessly and delusional, psychotic day and night. And oh yeah, it's Christmas. Imagine me, his 70-year-old mother, crying and praying every night, worrying, where is my son? Is he starving? Is he freezing? Is he somewhere hurt and can't get help? Is he alive or is he dead? Panicking every time the phone rang. The second charge came January 4th, a domestic violence charge against me, his mother. It was this traumatic experience that finally got him to medical treatment. But just consider the cost. 2 different charges in 2 different cities, and it took my son hurting me, who has never touched me before and never would, just to get help. All of these charges and trauma would have all been avoided if only one police department would have just taken him to the hospital. I implore you, pass the 1735 bill so no one, no other family will have to suffer as we are. We need your help now. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Diane, for your testimony. Next up is going to be Julie Barrett.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Dingra and committee members for allowing me to testify this morning. My name is Julie Barrett. I am a lifelong Snohomish County resident. I'm also the founder of Conservative Ladies of Washington. We have 10,000, represent 10,000 women statewide. I'm also a mom of 5 children. Last March, my 14-year-old daughter was rescued from a homeless youth shelter in Seattle by 8 Seattle police officers. It was the most terrifying experience of my life as a mom. When the anti-police laws passed and took effect in July, I realized that those police officers would not have been able to save my daughter after those laws have passed. So I'm here today in support of House Bill 1735. I work with a lot of law enforcement around the state in support and collaborating with them. And they tell me that this bill is a good bill and it provides clarification, but it could go further. So I would ask the committee to please work together with law enforcement around the state to make the tweaks and changes to this bill to give clarification so that our law enforcement can provide the service and protection that our communities so desperately need. So I would ask you to pass this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up is going to be Will Rice.
Thank you very much. My name is Will Rice, and I'm the Agency Director for Catholic Community Services in the North Sound region of Western Washington. And before I start, I want to thank Diane for sharing what you did and putting a face on the conversation here, and I hope to do a little bit of that myself. As you know, Catholic Community Services is a core provider in the area of housing for those experiencing chronic homelessness. I'm speaking in support of Substitute House Bill 1735. We take on the risk to house those living on the streets or in the margins of Western Washington. The only way we've been able to do this successfully is with the partnership with local city and county law enforcement to assist when we have residents experiencing mental illness and are presenting safety risks beyond what we can mitigate with our de-escalation skills. What we experienced beginning last summer with the withdrawal of local law enforcement from our partnership was unfortunate and very dangerous. We repeatedly heard the message that you are on your own with your own residents decompensating with mental illness and presenting a serious risk to harm your staff or other residents. I want to describe for you just one incident that captures the danger and the need for a substitute House Bill 1735. In summer 2021, we had a resident experiencing serious mental illness and become very agitated and was presenting as a safety risk to our staff and residents. He violently punched his way through a plexiglass barrier we had erected in response to COVID-19 spread at our front desk. The glass shattered and cut the face of the staff person sitting on the other side of the front desk. We called our local city's police department. They arrived and told us that this person was experiencing a mental health condition and they were not going to detain this individual. They left the building and were on the sidewalk outside the building when the resident then turned and grabbed another staff person by the hair, drug her to the front door and threw her out the front door. Seeing this assault, the police responded and arrested the resident. We were very lucky that the staff person that was assaulted, the second person, was not hurt more severely. But let's not minimize the trauma and the impact of any assault. The point is, this second assault was completely preventable. And just a final point, the resident that we were housing that committed these assaults has been residing in Western State Hospital since the end of July 2021. Again, I speak in support of Substitute House Bill 1735 and consider it essential to restore the compact between community-based agencies and law enforcement that we need to be successful to take the risks associated with trying to house those that no one else will. Thank you very much, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Next up will be Lori Lane.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, I'm all for this bill. I'd like to see it be somewhat strengthened because I really feel there's some serious issues with the mental, but I'm glad that it's certainly heading in the right direction and I like to see this. One other thing I'd like to see happen is decent credentials on Western State Hospital, because that has been lagging for a very long time. I've heard horror stories of cops not being able to commit seriously mentally ill people there because it was not properly credentialed. That bothers me. And, you know, with a few tweaks, I think this would be a perfect bill. And I'd also like to see Western State be strengthened a lot more and be able to house these people. For too long, we've been against that. That needs to end. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next up is going to be Sheldon Peto.
Good morning, thank you. My name is Sheldon Beto, and I live in Kitsap County. I'm testifying in full support of Substitute House Bill 1735. Law enforcement officers must have a favorable landscape to do good police work, and this includes the use of force. Last year's reforms were unbalanced and fraught with emotion instead of reason. Law enforcement are the only people we ask to go into conflict and resolve what we ourselves cannot, what we have lost control of, or when we are preyed upon, usually in the native habitat of the problem. Since last year's reforms, we've had many examples of bad actors who continue to endanger us. The Facebook posts of the Pierce County Sheriff's Department are but one source to find examples of the chilling effect and destructiveness of last year's debacle. In conclusion, America has a nobility. It's its law enforcement officers. The law enforcement officer says, "I'll make life-altering decisions in fraction of seconds and with incomplete information. Decisions for which society has the luxury of time and stillness to deconstruct and critique the things that they themselves do not attempt. They deserve better than what the legislature has thus far delivered." Thank you.
Next up will be Janine Brookhart.
Hi, my name is Janine Brookhart, and I wholly support this bill. I think it's a great idea to make the police be a solution instead of a bystander. So anything that goes in that direction will be great for our citizens. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And next up will be Austin Field.
Hello again. As I stated, I represent the Seattle Community Police Commission. The CPC supports HB 1735, but we emphasize that Washington must create and prioritize non-law enforcement responses for behavioral health and mental health incidents. I want to acknowledge the powerful testimony that was offered by family members and service providers in this hearing. People experiencing mental health crises and those who care for them are often left with no good options because our state does not provide enough accessible, affordable mental health treatment and lacks sufficient unarmed medical responses to mental health crises. The University of Washington found that nearly half of Washington counties have no psychiatrists providing direct mental health treatment, and 25% of Washington residents have no access to mental health services at all, making Washington one of the worst states in the nation for mental health care access. And as we've heard, our state's lack of mental health care resources seriously threatens public safety. A very small percentage of people experiencing untreated mental illness will face a serious crisis and may resist treatment. And because we lack adequate numbers of effective mental health first responders, armed law enforcement officers may be the only available response. The CPC accepts this unfortunate reality, but we urge the legislature to create and fund effective mental health treatment and non-law enforcement mental health responders. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Do any of the members have any questions for any of the panelists? Okay. Seeing none, we are going to close the public hearing on Substitute House Bill 1735. Thank you, everyone who came today to testify. And with that, we will close the Law and Justice Committee for today. Thank you all. Bye-bye.